This is Craft Council from the Craft Council. Conversations with makers about their craft, their challenges, and the ideas that shape their future. For more information, find us via the Craft Council website, www.craftcouncil.org.uk, or on Instagram at Craft Council.
Hello and welcome to Crafts Council from Crafts Council. I'm Anna Fielding.
And I'm Lewis Taunton-Gilbert.
And with us today we have Chris Day. Chris creates works using free-blown glass and other media. This work is shown internationally and can be found in the V&A, the National Museum of Scotland and many other museums and galleries. Hello Chris, great to have you with us.
No, thank you for inviting me.
To ease us in, we wondered if you could describe your studio space where you make all of these incredible works.
See, that's the biggest problem I'm facing, and I have faced since university, is studio space. Being a glassblower is that you need a hot shop, you need a furnace, you need a leer, and all this equipment, especially at the moment with the heat crisis that we're all going through, it costs so much money. So I'm a nomadic glass artist, and I just rent studio spaces. It frees me up as an artist, to be honest, is that if I had a studio space where I had all this equipment, and the rents and everything else that goes with a studio, is that I'd perhaps have to make pretty things. And that's what I don't do. So it enables me to be an artist and create pieces of work about identity, racism, lynching, anything, the black experience, I suppose. So it frees me up to be able to do that. Whereas I think if I had a studio all of my own, like I say, I'd be just making pretty things to pay the bills. And although this does pay part of the bill, the main passion is the conversation which the work creates.
Where do you find these spaces that you work in?
At the moment, I'm luckily, I'm in the Midlands, so I work from Stourbridge Glass Museum, Alistair Malcolm's studio, and if that's not available, it's at Ruskin Mill at Stourbridge Glass Studio, which is run by Vic and Ian Bamford. And sometimes it can be down to price, or it can just be what's available at the time. Believe it or not, it's quite hard to get into a studio because they're having to produce work themselves. So they steady me in and squeeze me in whenever they can.
But that hiring of studio spaces, can you speak more about how that allows you to be more sort of fluid in your own practice?
For me, it's great. I mean, I'm a plumbing and heating engineer, and I still am. And the freedom that it gives me renting, if we could put it that, or using a studio space that isn't mine, it enables me to create pieces of work that are heartfelt. And for me, it's everything. If somebody comes up with a commission or an exhibition, I'm in the studio. Other than that, I can't get into a studio. One, because I can't afford to go into a studio. And two, is that I don't want to waste materials just experimenting and examining what I could do in the future. I mean, a studio cost can be anything. And if we go the demographic of Great Britain, it can be anything from up north. It would be £600. Coming down south, it could be £1,500, you know. So I'm sort of like in the middle. And it's an expense where I can't use that just to experiment. I haven't got that kind of money. But when a commission comes along, then off we go. And, you know, you've got that funding and a budget to be able to utilise that to enable you to experiment sometimes. But even when I experiment, I'm still thinking about the cost that's involved. Mm. So every time that you go in, you think, I've got to make something and I've got to create something. I'm doing a commission at the moment. And in my head, it's like, I can't afford for this to go wrong. It's got to hit the floor running. And I think as an artist and somebody that's trying to research into different aspects of the materials, is that that's the thing I can't do. But I really do try. And it's a battle you have to do, is that, you know, bless him, I've got Angel at Vessel Gallery that is like my mentor. He's not just not my gallerist. And I phone him up and he gives me advice of, you know, mainly is that just go and make. You know, forget all the barriers that might come about making. Don't think about the costs or this, that and the other. Just go in and create. And having someone behind you, giving you that confidence to do that, is that I'm hung up on, it's costing me this much. I've got to make this. I've got to create this. It's got to be, you know, all the other things that go with creating a commission when other people are involved. You're thinking about everybody else except for yourself as an artist. You know, and like Angel says, just go in there and create. Be you. And I think as soon as he said that, everything else disappears. Mm. And you just go into the studio and you do that. You play and you create. So one bit's, you know, it's like having two devils, well, and a devil and an angel, angel being Angel Monson, is that you've got, you know, one saying, it's costing you a hell of a lot to use this space, and then the other one saying, don't worry about it. But you still have that conflicting thing about creating. And I think the way glass is at the moment, it'll always be that way. The price is only going up and up and up.
Mm.
But I've still got to create pieces of artwork. I've still got to create conversations. So it's just a thing that I have to get over.
How do you channel your creativity when you're not in the studio? Do you like sketches or?
No, I'm a bit void that way. Sketching, you know, I should be sketching and painting, but everything's in my head. And even Angel, he'll say to me, he'll say, you know, create some sketches. But for me, the way I have to sketch is with a copper. I can draw something, but to turn that into reality and the stuff that I do blowing into these copper cages is that I can draw something, but I've got to see how the copper interacts and what that shape looks like in 3D. When we draw, I am a good drawer, but it's mainly just a front view of what you're going to create. But when it comes to glass, you've got these three dimensions. And I've never really drawn in three dimensions, but the copper and me tying it together or binding it together, it gives me a way of seeing how this glass is going to go into there and how it's going to form and the problems that might arise. I can look at it and I can see it. So that's what I do sketch-wise. It's been a battle I've had ever since university. My tutors used to say, where's your sketchbook? And I used to go, ta-da, there it is on the table. There'd be cages left, right and centre full of glass being blown into them. And I said, this is my sketchbook. I can see what I've done on that piece of work and I can see a problem and I'll resolve it on the next piece of work. Whereas sketching to me is just ideas and but putting it into practice is a totally different thing. And I think that's the total thing about glass making and blowing is that it's the physicality of what this glass is going to actually do that we really don't know sometimes, especially my practice is that I like the glass to do some of the work or perhaps most of the work. And I'm so intrigued when it goes wrong as well. And I think that's what you can't do with a sketch. You can sketch something, but how do you know if it's going to work? So you've got to be able to create this piece and see what the glass will do. And them happy accidents are great because it's like, oh, wow, I didn't expect that. And you just carry on from that and go, you know, I mean, I can remember one piece of work I did. I thought it'd be brilliant and it ended up looking like a Hovis loaf. It was totally not what I expected. But from that one experience is that, right, I know what that's going to do. I didn't like that. I'll do something different. And the next piece, it was like, wow, thank God for that. It's worked.
You mentioned your copper cages there. And I know that they've got a symbolic as well as a material value for you as well.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously starting university at a tender age of 48 is that I was a plumbing and heating engineer and still am. And it was a place where, or an organisation that I'd never felt invited to. So I wanted to take something with me that I love as my career, which is a plumber. So copper. And I think when I first started university is that I wanted to show people. Now, remember, when I was growing up, the only people that went to university was either the rich kids or the very intelligent ones. And I didn't fit any of that criteria. So I took the copper in and I thought, I'm going to show people that plumbers can be artists. Why not? I'd never seen a plumber out there expose himself as an artist. So I thought, yeah, I'm going to do that. And then through education and research into my own heritage and my own ancestral history and the aspects that had happened throughout time is that it's more than just being a plumber. This copper isn't just about somebody who's using this material in his career. This material was used during the slave trade to make manilas that were the currency to buy Africans. The copper was used for ballast. There was so much more about the copper than just me being a plumber. Now, is it something from my ancestral DNA that's helped me tell this story, or is it just things that I've picked up? But for me, the copper isn't just about a plumber. It's about confinement. When I make these cages, just the word cage, You know, you're blowing into something that something or the material's trying to escape from. And I think hidden through all this is that I was talking about slavery and the civil rights and all sorts of things, but actually that cage was my own cage as well. I didn't know at the time. I wanted to talk about me being mixed race when I first started uni, but I didn't have the confidence. I needed to tell other people's stories to gain that confidence to tell my own story. And I can remember starting my MA and I put that down. I'm going to talk about being mixed race. I never did. All the way through my MA, I still didn't have that confidence. But what did give me was the other stories. All these other cages I was creating about other aspects, actually, my own cage. I feel a bit more comfortable to talk about that. And the first piece of work was Colourblind. And it wasn't about me. It was about me. But then the people that you get in contact with through exhibitions and talking, and people contacting you saying, Chris, thank you so much for telling our story. That's when it starts to get powerful. And I think all them things of all these barriers is that, yeah, I'm doing it for myself. But actually now there's other people that can understand what I'm doing. And yeah, it's been such a journey from a plumber that's working 7 days a week, just solely doing plumbing, to then talking about lynching, the civil rights, identity, you know, even my own aspects. It's just mind-blowing. It's absolutely mind-blowing. And I still have to pinch myself every day that this is real.
You know, you started talking about it already, but what was your journey into glassblowing? Did it start when you did your master's degree?
Well, it was my BA, but I didn't even want to go to university. It was my wife. And what a strong person she is. She was already studying at Wolverhampton University. And the conversations were, what have you done all day? And I used to say, I've been plumbing. I've been doing electrics. And I think that's all I had in me at that time, because I wasn't open to what was happening in the world. I was just solely concentrated on my career, earning money and plumbing. And she says, you've got to go to university. And I'm like, how am I going to get to university? You know, what's it going to do for me? And she says, well, I don't care. You're going. So we went to an open day and I wanted to do something that I'd never had the opportunity as a kid. And what I wanted to do when I left school was go to art college or art school. But they told me at the time is that you've got to do maths and English. And I didn't realise then that I was dyslexic. I struggled all the way through the educational system, but I was great at art and I loved it. But when they said you've got to do maths and English for a year or 2 years, that was it. The barriers came down and I never went. So the open day, they had an applied arts into glass and ceramics. And I thought, that's a T-shirt I've never worn. I've never had the opportunity to go on a wheel this glass furnace and this leer and all this hot molten glass. I'd never seen anything like it ever. And so I thought, yeah, I'll give that a go. And the bad devil was saying, how are you going to do this when you leave university? So I just did pottery. I did a ceramic wheel and ceramics. I thought, I can get a potter's wheel in my garage. I can get a little kiln and I can do that. So I didn't even touch glass because the bad devil was saying, you'll never make any money out of this. But through the course is obviously you've got to do a foundation in glass. And at that time, I was just starting to study about slavery as well. And as soon as I got hold of the first piece of glass on this iron, is that obviously I've got no experience and no control. And when this glass ended up on the floor, I loved that aspect of me not being in control for once. I think all my life I've either been controlled or I've had to be in control being a plumber. Different legislations and different things and rules is that, you know, you can't go outside them rules trying to fit in. You don't fit this box, you don't fit that box. So I've always been orchestrated in who I am as a person. And glass, when I seen that fall on the floor, nothing's controlling it. If you just let it be, it will just fall off. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And that's all I've done ever since, is that I blow into these cages and 50% is me and 50% is the glass doing what it wants. And I think that other 50% of the glass is actually me. That's what I want to be. I want to be out of control. I want to do whatever I want. But everybody knows society won't let you do that. But as an artist, we are allowed that. We are allowed to be out of control and not fit in boxes and create things that people have never seen before or aren't the norm. And that's what I love about art. It's not the prettiest pictures that look like photographs. It's the stuff that looks absolutely weird and unrecognisable of what it should be. And that intrigues me. So, yeah, that's how I got into glass, down to my wife doing something that I'd never done before.
It really sounds like craft has kind of given you a voice. But I wondered if you could speak more about what craft means to you.
I think I edged on it then, isn't it? Is that it's a hard one because I think when you talk, you don't want to upset people. But what I see craftspeople, if I take glass, is that it's exquisite. It's been exquisite for hundreds of years. And the craftsmanship and the dedication that artists put into making a goblet that might end up in a second-hand store is unbelievable. You know, all them processes and the craft, it ends up in a second-hand store. So for me, craft is using them techniques, but for me, using them as a conversational piece. You know, the pieces that I create, I've been extremely fortunate that they are in museums and they are creating conversations, and that's more important. But craft enables me to do that. If I wrote a book, if I could write a book, would that do it? It might do, but it's only going to hit a certain sector of society. When people see my work in different museums, is that it's the mums and dads that are going out for a day out. It's the school kids coming in on a bus. It's the aunts and the uncles. You know, it's for me, it's everyday folk that can engage with this piece of work that has got craftsmanship has in, into it. It has got that historical way of creating things, but it's gone past that of just being a craft now. It's turned into a conversation. It's turned into society. It's turned into more than just being in this small box of craft. So that's what craft really means to me, is sort of like creating pieces of work that engage a wider society. And for me, not showing off. The only thing I'm showing off is the conversations. For me as a maker, I'm not showing off my ability at all. Although I have got ability, is that that is not the sole purpose. And that's what craft means to me, is that it's just a way of engaging with other people about subjects that perhaps are unconfrontational or confrontational, but giving them an easier way to be able to talk about these things.
When did you feel ready to start having those conversations with your work?
University was my nursery. When I first started, believe it or not, I had a bit of a stammer. Obviously, that was because I had low self-esteem and confidence that as soon as I tried to talk to even my tutors, is that I'd get extremely nervous. So I would say university is where I started the conversations, and not with... I was scared to death of my tutors, although they've turned into good friends now, you know. But it was conversations with other students, and not all about me and not all about what I was researching, but listening to them. I think that's the biggest problem, is that perhaps people are too talking about themselves all the time and they don't listen to other people. So when I was creating pieces of work, and I can remember one lady, bless her, is that she came up, she says, "Chris, I love your work, but it means so much more to me." And it was a piece of glass in a cage again. And she come up and she says, "I was sexually abused as a child. I've never told this to anybody." So all of a sudden, you're there in front of somebody that's never, ever said anything about this. But your piece of work has gave her a safe place to be able to tell a total stranger about something that happened to her. And that's like, I mean, even now I'm getting shudders, is that that's when I realised how powerful art could be. And I didn't realise that. You know, when you go to museums and look at pieces of work, is that perhaps you don't realise what that person was creating. But when I think if Van Gogh could hear what people were saying about his work, and I had that pleasure of listening to somebody describe something that they'd gone through because of what my work had aroused. And it's just, it's overwhelming. That's where my confidence started to build up, is that I was talking to other people, listening to them and creating conversations just on a slow thing. But the biggest one was lockdown, having to do Zoom calls without a physical audience in front of you, just this little screen with little faces. But if anybody could see well, it was my conservatory at the time, behind that screen, there was layers and layers and layers of paperwork to remind me of what to say. But what I realised is that I didn't need all them papers. I didn't need all the things to remind me. Being dyslexic, you'd forget stuff. Is that I found out that everything I needed to say came from the heart. So all the nudges and reminders of Emmett Till's and Lynching and Billie Holiday, because I couldn't remember the names even then, is that actually the more I spoke, the more I could remember. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that I didn't need to know, didn't really remember, but the good stuff. I mean, if you ask me dates and times, I can't remember them, but are they really important? I think it's more what happened was the most important thing. So COVID was great, not for some people, but it was great for me as a confidence builder and giving me that time to realise that I can talk, but I've just got to get rid of all the rubbish stuff that perhaps people don't want to listen to and just say the stuff that got me excited or emotional.
But I can confirm there's no visual prompts around here today. No, it's all from the heart.
There's nothing.
I mean, you're talking about the power of art there. What other artists and makers inspire you?
Oh, you know what? On the train down here, I was talking to a total stranger and we went through everything and I was talking about art. And I told him a scenario that I went through at university is that one of the lecturers was telling me about Grayson Perry. And at that time, because I was interested in the historical facts that had happened, I wasn't really studying other artists as such. But I was, but not Grayson Perry's. Although I love his work and him as a person, it didn't do anything for me. But what did do it for me was, you imagine I'm a blank canvas, this plumbing and heating engineer, entering university, not knowing anything, not knowing any artwork, because I'd not done it since I was 16. And then being hit with somebody like Grayson Perry. And I said to him, I says, what's that got to do with lynching? What's that got to do with the civil rights movement? What's that got to do with Emmett Till? And what I understood was, they'd been taught by somebody that told them about somebody that told them. But they'd missed out that blackness that I was showing through my work. I wanted to know about Kara Walker. But when you ask people at the university, do you know of Kara Walker's work? It's like, who's that? And I was like astonished. Why don't you know about Kara Walker? And then the black art movement, you know, Sonia Boyce, Keith Piper. They didn't even know about them. And I think that made me more determined to find more black artists. So then you Googling, I thought, I'll find some black glass blowers. The only thing that come up on my search was black glass. No black glass artists. So then you diversify and you spread it a bit, black artists. Or political black artists, you know, because I wanted to find out if what people were creating. So Kara Walker, lovely work, but very explicit. Fred Wilson, brilliant work, but gets you mind thinking. And I thought, that's what I want to be. I want to be a Fred Wilson. As soon as I seen his conceptual pieces that were talking about racism, and he did a piece out of glass called Drip Drop Plop, and it was this whimsical piece of glass that got these googly eyes on it, but it was talking about the racial slurs and how identity was made a fun of in America. And I thought, that's brilliant. Because the first, when you see it, is that you don't think it's racism. It's not talking about racism. I thought, that's what I want to do. So it was, and he's not a glass maker himself, you know, he's a conceptual artist and curator. But I had to find all these people. You know, people talk about Van Gogh and Constable and Turner, and everybody knows them. But when it comes to black artists, there's like this void of, why don't you know? And I'm embarrassed because I don't know. And I don't know all of them. But when I do come across them, I try to catalogue it in my own brain to try and remember it. And not to educate people, but just point them in the right direction, is that there's other artists out there that are creating similar work to Grayson Perry. But, yeah.
What made you want to have those conversations around race and lynching and Emmett Till? Like, what was the catalyst for you?
I think it was the emotion. And this is where, if I started at the beginning, it's extremely emotional. Emmett Till. Even now, it brings shudders to me. I can visualise his face and the coffin and everything that's gone on. And I can remember studying at a weekend, reading. And I remember I'm dyslexic, so most of my reading was imagery. And when you're looking at all this imagery, you get a bit, you know, distant from it. And then I went into university on the Monday, and I can remember it. And I'm there at my desk, and my tutor comes up. And I've made this bowl, and it's got blood splats all over, and it's got some glass in the top of it. And he's intrigued to find out what it's all about. And he says, Chris, what's this about? And I looked at this bowl, and I just burst out crying. And it must have took me 5 minutes. Luckily enough, Viv, a fellow student, just gave me a big hug, a proper mum hug, to calm me down. And I went back, and Max Stewart says, are you all right? And I says, yeah. I says, I can tell you about it now. And I said, Max, instead of crying, what I wanted to say was, I've created this bowl, but how big a bowl would I have to create to catch the tears of the mums, the dads, the brothers, the sisters, the uncles that have cried for their loved ones just because of the colour of the skin after watching what had happened to Emmett Till, seeing his mother over the coffin crying her eyes out of what they'd done to his son brutally. But I couldn't do that at that time. I could only just cry because the pictures that I'd seen at the weekend had just built up and up, and I didn't even know at the time. And then it just burst down. And it was that catalyst of the bowl, Max asking me, and then realising that I've got to get these conversations out, but I just can't cry about it. I've got to be a bit more hard-faced, put that passion and that emotion out there, but not blubbering. So that was the first time I knew that anything that I come across, and that's what it was about. It wasn't about me getting down on a knee and putting a fist in the air and saying, oh, this is all wrong. It was me just finding all this stuff on the internet. And then, do you know about Emmett Till? Do you know about this? Do you know about that? You know, George Stinney, a 14-year-old boy that was electrocuted. I mean, it's just impossible to imagine, all because society at that time thought it was right. And so for me, it was just, I've got to tell people about these. And especially when you go back to the Grayson Perry thing, is that my tutors didn't know about Cara Walker or Fred Wilson, is that I was the same. I didn't know about Emmett Till or George Stinney. I didn't know about these people. Embarrassed, but I've got to tell other people about this now. So that's where it all started, really, was Emmett Till. And that's why I've got such a, you know, people, I mean, Emmett Till's in the V&A. And people ask me, what's your most, you know, your best piece of work? It's more memorable for me. It's not my best piece of work because I'm still trying to do my best piece of work. The most memorable is always going to be Emmett Till, and not because it's in the V&A. It could have been in Wolverhampton Gallery for me. It's just that that story now is being told in a place where it never got told before. And so that's, you know, that's what all this is about, is just telling stories.
If it's not too difficult for you, would you mind just telling the listeners who maybe don't know about Emmett Till, just the story?
Yeah, I mean, I can do it. It is hard. So Emmett Till, 14-year-old boy, was lynched. And all he was lynched for was to go into a convenience store. And the story is that he either wolf whistled or he made a remark to the person behind the counter, who was female, and her brothers took exception to this. So they went to the house where he was stopping. Now, I'm sure he was from New York and he was only visiting. He wasn't even a resident down there, which was the Deep South at the time. And they've got him and they said, where's Emmett? They've pulled him out, put him into a truck, took him into a field, tied him round a tree, shot his ear off, done other stuff brutally to him. and then bound him to an industrial fan and chucked him into the river. And then after a certain amount of time, his body was found. The story of everything, the brutal and the racism, is, to me, it wasn't important. The most important part was how brave his mum was in having an open casket at that time and showing what these people had done to her son. And the images of this beautiful boy with like a hat on, and he's just gorgeous, and then this brutalized figure in this coffin. And that's what got me, was just seeing his mum and me as a father. If that was my son, could I have been that brave to have done that? The emotions must have been running so high for her, but she knew she had a role to show people what they'd done. And that's what Emmett means to me, is that at a time, just showing that emotion, and she's just such a brave person, is just showing people what humans can do to other humans. But I want to be the other side of that, is to show, you know, what we can do and what we can perhaps change. And that's what she was trying to do. I mean, the civil rights movement was just starting to be orchestrated and kick off. But that one instance hit the papers and it skyrocketed from there. So, you know, great. It's not even a nice word, is it? It's not a great story at all. We shouldn't even be saying it's a great story, but an episode of time that changed time as well. You know, so it's such an important part of me as a maker. I mean, if you could cut me in half, I'd have Emmett Till at the core of me, because that's where it all started for me. I feel like a record sometimes, because I always talk about Emmett Till, but because I've got such a passion for the story, what it did to me as this plumber that just knows about plumbing and electrical work, to give me that inspiration to actually tell his story and other stories, is that I'm always going to pick it up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important part of history and such a landmark case that I think probably obviously echoes your experiences, like maybe in 2020 when George Floyd was killed, and, you know, you were studying at that time as well.
No, and that's the other. There's a catalyst for me. And I put these elements in there. My wife sending me to university. George Floyd, an Angel Monzon Vessel Gallery. If you take any of them out, I wouldn't be sat here in front of you two talking, I don't think. People have reported that, oh, we would have come across Chris eventually, or we'd have found it. But I'm thinking, how? Absolutely how? Without George Floyd, is that at the time, I was creating pieces. I had Strange Fruit that's now in tour in America. Everybody was scared. I could see people go up to it, read the artist's statement and walk away from it. They didn't want to engage with the conversations, what I was trying to create. I can remember Stourbridge Biennale, Glass Biennale, and that's where I met Angel, bless him. Everybody walked away. There was no interviews, there was no magazines, there was no publications. I think I got one person that did a little bit of a write-up. And it was nice, but it wasn't about what I wanted to say. It was more like there was this strange piece of work that was hanging.
Well, no, but actually, while you were on that, could you speak more about Strange Fruit, the piece that's touring currently?
Yeah, so Strange Fruit was my first piece that I'd exhibited in an exhibition, and that was at Stourbridge Biennale, like I say, where I met Angel. So Strange Fruit, the hanging installation, is created from blown glass into these wire cages. And for me, I wanted to create a piece of work that perhaps everybody could resonate with. And when I was growing up, you'd go past a butcher's shop and you'd see pieces of meat hanging. You don't see it very often now. They're all plastic packages up and in supermarkets. But, you know, when I was about, we had proper butcher's shop. So what I wanted to create was this facade of these hanging pieces of meat. Sounds gory, but these meat wasn't pieces of legs of lamb. These were bodily parts, but not bodily parts where you could see an arm and a leg or any torsos of whatever. It was just a ball of glass that was trying to break free. But the thing that made it strange was the way I'd hung it. At the top of the glass, there's a noose, obviously going back to lynching. But on the rail at the top where they all hung were these butcher's hooks, reverting back to being in a shop window. So you've got these pieces of glass that are lynched, that have got a noose round them, hanging from these butcher's hooks. But people can't see these bodily parts. They can just see these nice shiny pieces of glass. And that's where the confrontation of, if I did put a piece of bodily part up there, I think people would walk away. But because it doesn't look like that, people were drawn to it. The only thing that made them turn away from it was the artist's statement. They didn't want to engage. George Floyd made that possible. We've had racism since Emmett Till, George Stinney, you know, other people in America that have been lynched and created a bit of a hype. That's all I'm going to call it, because this conversation has been going on for hundreds of years. But people get onto board, they demonstrate, then it dies down. What we've seen with George Floyd was a huge turning point, not just for me as an artist, but for organisations, is that they realised that they needed to change. But for me, I mean, you could say the black art movement of the 80s did a lot of foundation and groundwork. But what had happened after that? What artists were around creating works about racism at that time? And everybody just lynched onto me. And I'm going to, all thanks to Angel, because at the time of the rioting that was going on with the Black Lives Movement after George Floyd, is that he had strange fruit hanging in his gallery window, not hidden away in the back room or downstairs, actually in the window. And people had said to Angel, you know, is this, do you know what you're doing sort of thing? You know, you're going to create a divide. And he just, not bothered. I'm going to do it anyway. You know, even people said, are you going to board up in case the windows get smashed? But he was brave enough to take a stance. And I'd even actually said to Angel, I said, you know, we're both taking a stance here. We're both putting our heads above the parapet, waiting for all this influx of negativity to come. Thankfully, it didn't. And I think this is all because of George again, is that he changed people's mindsets, is that we've got to engage, we've got to create conversations, we've got to talk about aspects. He did that. And Angel's got so many people that he knows that also were interested in the work, that he created a slide for me to go down and enjoy. And it's horrible, isn't it, is that I enjoy what I do, but I do enjoy. I don't like the brutality that's gone about my work, but I enjoy the conversations that it's created about the work.
Well, it's incredibly important to have that. So, yeah, thank you for bringing visibility to such important stories. How do you create these works? Like, what tool could you not live without when you're making these pieces?
The story. That's it. If I could put an orange on a plinth and talk about racism, I would do. But I don't think people would be interested. So for me, the story comes first. And that's why I perhaps don't go into a studio and just practice and create things, is because I need that story. I can't make 100 Emmett Tills and sell them. There's one Emmett Till, there's one piece of work dedicated to him. Mm. And it's like all the other pieces of work. There's perhaps groups of work that are saying the same story, because that's what an installation needs, but the story comes first and then the work. So that would be my main tool. The second one would be the copper cage. And I think it's moved its roles for me, as in, obviously, it was a way of talking about slavery and confinement and trying to break free and, the struggle that humans have. But then that cage turned into my own identity and talking about that. And then realising we've all got cages that we are prone to and trying to break free from, even if it's just the mortgage, you know. So for me, the copper, it's me. It's what I've done for 30-odd years as a plumber. So if you took away the story and the copper, that would be the most important. Glass is glass. Glass is beautiful on its own. It doesn't need a copper and it doesn't need a story. But it turns even more beautiful when it has got that copper and it has got that story related to it.
This is something you've kind of touched on already, I think, particularly when you were talking about studio space. But What obstacles do you face in terms of getting your work made?
Studios. That's the biggest problem. I highlighted earlier how much it costs to get into a studio. I would love to go in and just play and not have that thought of, oh, am I going to afford this, or I've got to save up for perhaps 6 months, 3 months to get into a studio. So that is my biggest barrier, is just getting into a studio. You know, money, studio, everything else I can figure out. You know, artwork and stories. There's thousands of stories out there I'd love to create a piece of work about. But my biggest barrier is a studio and finance. That's it. There's nothing else that holds me. And then, you know, when I do get sponsored or commissioned, it's not a problem. That barrier goes. There's no other barriers holding me back. Exhibition spaces, that's not really an issue now. I think it was when I first started, but people won't realise I've been so lucky. I call myself the Cinderella. Unfortunately, Angel, you're my godmother. I don't know who the ugly sisters are at the moment. Perhaps it's the politicians. But it is a fairy tale thing for me, is that I feel like Cinderella. I feel that this is all going to end at 12 o'clock and I'm going to turn into rags, you know. But it is a fairy story, and everything else, you know, exhibition spaces, being in magazines, being in museums, it's people wish they could do an eighth of what I've been able to do. So I don't take absolutely nothing for granted at all. You know, when a museum comes up, it's not, oh no, not another museum. It's like, wow, it's an opportunity for somebody else to see my work. And I wish every museum could buy a piece, because then I could perhaps be in the studio every day. But I've been extremely lucky. Like I say, the boundaries for me are just being able to afford us to go into the studio. And for me, I only have to go in perhaps once or twice a year. And the work that's generated from that creates a year's worth of conversations. And that's what's most important, is that I don't need to create 20 pieces of work to create a year's worth of conversation. I can remember at Two Temple Place, Judge and Jury, it was one piece of work that was commissioned or subsidised for me to create, which I created in America and brought that back. But that dialogue has then, that piece of work's gone from Stourbridge to Two Temple Place to various other places. So it just keeps going and going.
Well, you described yourself as Cinderella. But if I was going to grant you a wish and you could master any other craft, what would it be and why?
Bronze casting. Obviously with a copper, if I can just turn it to bronze and then do sculptural work out of bronze. But I just think if I could do bronze casting, yeah, it's still reverting back to slavery, you know, the bronze manillas. And I'd love to cast a huge, perhaps manila, and then having the glass involved with that. It's another T-shirt I haven't got. Mm. It's another material. It's almost, you know, pottery I can do. I can draw. I can do carpentry. I can do woodwork. But bronze casting, it's another material that's sort of like, it's inaccessible. Or it is accessible, as long as you've got the money and the funding, again. But yeah, that would be perhaps my go-to, is bronze casting.
If both money, time, and crucially with glass, I think, the laws of physics were no object to what you could make, what would you choose to make?
Oh, you've asked it at the wrong time.
What have I done, Chris? Yeah.
So my commission at the moment, it's taken me way out of my comfort zone. But what I really wanted to have a go at is make a light installation, as in like a chandelier, but it's not a chandelier whatsoever. So I'm already on that path, is that if, like you say, if money was no object, which this is a bit tight, but what would you want to make? It'd be a big light installation. And that's what I'm doing at the moment. And I'm absolutely scared to death, because it's, you know, I can do sculptural work, I can make things that go on plinths, and I can make things that go on walls. But when you talk about something that's not that I make, it's great. It's scary, but it's great. But that's what I'd love to do. And the other thing is, if money was no object, is that it's perhaps going past your remit of what you've asked me, is that engaging kids, my heart sinks when I see venues and exhibition spaces and things that are happening, and it's like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It's like, where's all the kids? But they're not being taught at school to engage with art, so obviously they're not going to go to the museums because they haven't been injected with that curiosity. But for me, if money was no object, I would love a glass studio where kids from the ages of 14 could come in and just have a go and be directed into doing something creative with glass. They might not carry it on all their lives. They might go a different path, but at least you've got them building their self-confidence. And that's the big thing that glass gave me. Yeah, it's gave me museums, it's gave me publicity. But if I could underline the most important thing it gave me was confidence and getting rid of the stigma of who Chris Day was to what Chris Day is now. So, yeah, money, making things, I think just inspiring kids. I'd forget about making stuff out of bronze, to be honest. You know, I'd rather just engage with kids, which I am doing. It has started, the ball has started rolling, and we are starting to go into schools and just trying to inspire them and talk to them and tell them my story. And, you know, and like you say, I think everybody's a Cinderella. Everybody's got these dreams, and we all need fairy godmothers. We all need somebody to inspire us. And I've had that. So now hopefully I can pass that on to a younger generation. They might not do anything in arts. They might go football, or they might do creative dancing, or whatever. They might do bricklaying. But as long as you can inspire them and think that, you know, it's all accessible, as long as you've got a good support mechanism around you.
That flows very nicely into our last question, which is, do you have any advice for fellow makers, young makers, or what's the best piece of advice that you've been given?
I think I've just edged on it, support. Mm. You've got to get a good support mechanism around you. Like I say, I've been lucky. It's came to me. But I think the biggest one is, don't be scared to approach people, because people won't know you're there if you don't go and talk about it or shout about it. You know, a baby cries, somebody goes to it and tries to calm it down. And I think that's us as human beings, is that if we don't shout and cry, nobody knows what you want. So approach, you know, I've spoke to people, fellow artists, perhaps just starting in the career, and I'm not ready. We all hear it. I've been there. I'm not ready to do an exhibition. I haven't got enough work, or it's not good enough. Why isn't it good enough? You're your only barrier now, because you're saying that you're not good enough. If you don't tell me what's not right with your work, I'm never going to know. Just do it. Just be brave enough to say, look, this is what I've created. It's only one piece of work. Go to a gallery, see what they say. But I always say, if they say it's not what we're after, say, do you know somebody that could perhaps be interested, or mentor me, or, you know, don't just say, oh, but, you know, get the negative and then just walk away. Try and induce something else that might guide you to somebody else that might be interested in the work. So for me, support mechanism, be brave. Don't be scared to knock on doors. You know, you're going to knock on doors and you're going to get refused, but there might be just one door that will open to you. But if you don't go knocking, then nobody's going to come. So that's my biggest advice, I suppose, to people, is just be brave. And now's the right time. Don't wait for the right time. You know, it's never going to be, you know, if my wife says, if she said we're going to have three children, it's never going to be the right time to have three children. But they come along and you change. And I think it's the same for art, is that it's never, you're never going to have the right amount of work. You're never going to be satisfied with your work. So just be satisfied with what you've got. You've got work there. Go and plug it, you know.
Well, yeah, incredibly inspiring. I think that's something we should all do.
Absolutely.
But yeah, thank you for joining us here today.
Great to have you, Chris.
No, honestly, it's a pleasure to be invited. And, you know, I enjoy all these moments, because hopefully somebody will just pick up off what we've spoken today and perhaps be inspired to do what they're doing.
I'm sure they will. And we look forward to seeing your light installation.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes.
Thank you so much, Chris Day.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Crafts Council from Crafts Council. Join us next time as we continue the conversation with fashion designer Phoebe English.